My original plan had been to sell the horses to the Hyksos quartermasters in the port of Thebes, but no man who knew horse flesh would look at this pitiful herd. Huey and I decided upon another course. We timed the last leg of our voyage to arrive at Thebes as the sun was setting. My heart ached as I recognised all the familiar landmarks. The walls of the citadel glowed pinkly in the last rays of the sun. Those three elegant towers that I had built for Lord Intef still pointed to the sky. They were aptly named the Fingers of Horus. The palace of Memnon on the west bank, which I had left uncompleted, had been rebuilt by the Hyksos. Even I had to admit that the Asiatic influence was pleasing. In this light, the spires and watchtowers were endowed with a mysterious and exotic quality. I wished that my mistress was there to share this moment of homecoming with me. We had both longed for it over half her lifetime. In the fading light, we were able to make out the vast concourse of men and horses and chariots and wagons that lay outside the city walls. Although I had received accurate reports, it had not been possible to visualize such multitudes. My spirits quailed as I looked upon them, and remembered the gallant little army I had left at Elephantine. We would need every favour of the gods, and more than a little good fortune to triumph against such a host. As the last light faded into night, the fires of the Hyksos bloomed and twinkled upon the plain like a field of stars. There was no end to them. They stretched away to the limit of the eye. As we sailed closer, we smelled them. There is a peculiar odour that a standing army exudes. It is a blend of many smells, of dung fires and of cooking food, the sweet smell of new-cut hay and the ammoniacal smell of the horses, and the stench of human sewage in open pits, of leather and pitch and horse sweat and wood shavings and sour beer. Most of all, it is the smell of men, tens of thousands of men living close to each other in tents and huts and hovels. We sailed on, and the sounds floated across the starlit waters to our silent ship. The snort and the whinny of horses, the sound of the coppersmith's hammers on the anvil beating out spearheads and blades, the challenges of the sentries and the voices of men singing and arguing and laughing. I stood beside the captain on the deck of the leading galley and guided him in towards the east bank. I remembered the wharf of the timber merchants outside the city walls. If it still stood, it would be the best point at which to disembark our herd. I picked out the entrance to the dock, and we pushed in under oars. The wharf was exactly as I remembered it. As we came alongside, the harbour master came fussing on board, demanding our papers and our license to trade. I fawned upon him, bowing and grinning obsequiously. "Excellency, there's been a terrible accident. My licenses were blown from my hand by the wind, a trick of Seth, no doubt." He blew himself up like an angry bullfrog, and then subsided again as I pressed a heavy gold ring into his fat paw. He tested the metal between his teeth and went away smiling. I sent one of the grooms ashore to douse the torches that illuminated the wharf. I did not want curious eyes to see the condition of the horses that we brought ashore. Some of our animals were too weak to rise, others staggered and wheezed. They drooled the stinking mucus from mouth and nostrils. We were forced to place head halters on them and coax them out of the barge onto the wharf. In the end, there were only 100 horses strong enough to walk. We led them down the wagon track to the high ground where our spies had told us the main horse lines were laid out. Our spies had also provided us with the password of the Hyksos 1st Division of Chariots, and the linguists among us replied to the challenge of the sentries. We walked our horses the entire length of the enemy encampment. As we went, we began to turn our stricken animals loose, leaving a few of them to wander through the lines of every one of the Hyksos 20 chariot divisions. We moved so casually and naturally that no alarm was raised. We even chatted and joked with the enemy grooms and horse handlers we met along the way. As the first streaks of dawn showed in the eastern sky, we trudged back to the timber wharf on which we had disembarked. Only one of the galleys had waited to take us off. The rest of the flotilla had cast off and turned back southwards as soon as they had discharged their cargo of diseased horses. We went aboard the remaining ship, and although Huey and the other grooms threw themselves exhausted upon the deck, I stood at the stern rail and watched the walls of my beautiful Thebes, washed by the pure early light, sink from view behind us. 10 days later we sailed into the port of Elephantine, and after I had reported to Pharaoh Temoza, I hurried to the water garden in the harem. My mistress lay in the shade of the baratza. She was pale, and so thin that I could not keep my hands from trembling, as I stretched out to her in obeisance. She wept when she saw me. "I missed you, Taita. There is so little time left for us to be together." The Nile began to shrink back into her bed. The fields emerged from under the inundation, glistening black under a thick new coat of rich mud. The roads began to dry out, opening the way northwards. Soon it would be time for the plough, and the time for war. Aten and I waited anxiously, perusing every report from our spies in the north. It came at last, the intelligence for which we had waited and prayed. The news was carried by a fast felucca, flying to us on the wings of the north wind. It docked in the third watch of the night, but the messenger found Aten and me still working by lamplight in his cell. I hurried with the dirty scrap of papyrus to the royal apartments. The guards had orders to let me pass at any hour, but Queen Massara met me at the curtained doorway to the king's bedchamber. "I will not let you wake him now, Taita. The king is exhausted. This is his first night's uninterrupted sleep in a month." "Your Majesty, I must see him. I am under his direct orders." While we still argued, a deep young voice called to me from beyond the curtain. "Is that you, Tata?" The curtain was thrown aside, and the king stood before us in all his naked splendour. He was a man as few others I had ever known, lean and hard as the blade of the blue sword, majestic in all his manly parts, so that I was all the more conscious of my own disability when I looked upon him. "What is it, Tata?" "Dispatches from the north, from the camp of the Hyksos. A terrible pestilence is sweeping through the lines of the Hyksos. Half their horses are stricken, and thousands of others fall prey to the disease with each new day." "You are a magician, Tata. How could we have ever mocked you and your gnu?" He gripped my shoulders and stared into my eyes. "Are you ready to ride to glory with me?" "I am ready, Pharaoh." "Then put rock and chain into the traces, and fly the blue pennant over my chariot. We are going home, to Thebes." So we stood at last before the city of 100 gates with 4 divisions of chariots and 30,000 foot. King Salatus' host lay before us, but beyond his multitudes the fingers of Horus beckoned to us, and the walls of Thebes shone with a pearly radiance in the dawn light. The Hyksos army deployed ponderously in front of us, like the uncoiling of some gigantic python, column after column, rank upon rank. Their spearheads glittered, and the golden helmets of the officers blazed in the early sunlight. "Where is Apachan and his chariots?" the king demanded, and I stared at the finger of Horus that stood nearest the river. I had to strain my eyesight to make out the tiny coloured scraps that waved from the top of the tower. "Apachan has 5 divisions in the centre, and he holds 6 more in reserve. They are hidden beyond the city wall." I read the flag signals of the spy I had posted in the tallest of the 3 towers. I knew that from there he had a falcon's view across the battlefield. "That is only 11 divisions, Tata," the king fumed. "We know he has 20. Where are the others?" "The Yellow Strangler," I answered him. "He has fielded every horse that can still stand." "By Horus, I hope you are right. I hope that Apachan is not planning a pretty little surprise for us." He touched my shoulder. "The dice are in the cup, Tata. It is too late to change them now. We must play this coup with what the gods have given us. Drive out in review." I took up the reins and wheeled the chariot out in front of our army. The king was showing himself to his troops. His presence would give them heart and stiffen their spines. I took the horses down the long ranks at a tight-hand trot. Rock and chain were brushed until their coats shone like polished copper in the sunlight. The carriage of the royal chariot was dressed in a thin skin of gold leaf. This was the only concession I had made in my quest for lightness. The gold was beaten thinner than a papyrus sheet, and it added less than 100 deben to the overall weight of our vehicle, yet it made a dazzling display. Friend or enemy who looked upon it could not doubt that this was Pharaoh's chariot, and take heart or be struck by awe in the thick of battle. On its long, whippy bamboo rod, the blue pennant nodded and streamed in the breeze high above our heads, and the men cheered us as we drove down their ranks. On the day we had left Kibui to begin the return, I had made a vow not to cut my hair until I had made sacrifice in the temple of Horus in the centre of Thebes. Now my hair reached to my waist, and to hide the streaks of grey in it, I had dyed it with henna imported from those lands beyond the Indus River. It was a ruddy gold mane that set off my beauty to perfection. I wore a simple starched kilt of the whitest linen, and the gold of praise upon my naked chest. I did not wish in any way to detract from the glory of my young pharaoh, so I wore no make-up and no other ornament. We passed in front of the massed regiments of the Shilluk spearmen in the centre. Those magnificent bloodthirsty pagans were the rock that anchored our line. They cheered as we rode by, "Kajan! Tanos! Kajan! Termoza!" Their ostrich feathers seethed white as the foam of the river in the cataracts as they raised their spears in salute. I saw Lord Krutas there in the midst of them, and he shouted at me. His words were lost in the roar of 10,000 voices, but I read his lips. "You and I will get puking drunk tonight in Thebes, you old hooligan." The Shilluk were stacked in depth, file upon file and regiment upon regiment. Krutas had exercised them ceaselessly in the tactics that I had helped him evolve to deal with chariots. Apart from their long spears, each of them carried a bundle of javelins and a sling of wood and leather to launch these with added power. They had set the sharpened wooden staves into the earth to form a palisade in front of their line. The Hyksos chariots had to break through that spiny barrier to reach them. The Egyptian archers were drawn up behind them, ready to move forward through their ranks or retreat again, as the vagaries of the battle called for each different tactic. They raised their recurved bows on high and cheered Pharaoh, "Termoza! Egypt and Termoza!" Pharaoh wore the blue war crown with the golden circlet of Uraeus upon his brow, the heads of the vulture and the cobra of the two kingdoms entwined, their jewelled eyes glittering. He returned their salute with the bare blade of his blue sword held high. We wheeled around our own left flank, and before we started back, Memnon stopped me with a hand on my shoulder. For a short while we looked back over the field. The Hyksos were moving forward already. Their front line was twice the length of our own. "From your own treatise, Tata," he quoted, "a circumspect defence until the enemy is committed, and then the rapid and audacious attack. You have remembered the lesson well, sire. It is certain we will be outflanked, and Apachan will probably throw in his first 5 chariot divisions at the start. I agree with you, Mem. But we know what we have to do, don't we, Tata?" He tapped my shoulder, and we started back to where our own chariots were holding in the rear. Remran headed the first division, Astes the second, and Lord Acre the third. Newly promoted to the rank of best of 10,000, Captain Huey commanded the 4th division. 2 regiments of Shilluk guarded our baggage and the spare horses. "Look at that old hunting dog," Memnon nodded at Remran. "He's chafing to be away. By Horus, I'll teach him a little patience before this day is done." We heard the horns sounding in the centre. "It begins now." Memnon pointed to the front, and we saw the Hyksos chariots looming through the dust clouds. "Yes, Apachan has turned loose his chariots." He looked back at our divisions, and Remren raised his sword high. "The first is ready, Majesty," he called eagerly, but Memnon ignored him and signalled to Lord Acre. The 3rd division came forward in column of 4s behind us, and Pharaoh led them out. The Hyksos chariots lumbered forward, heavy and majestic, aimed at the centre of our line. Memnon cut across in front of them, interposing our thin column between their hordes and the infantry. Then, at his signal, we wheeled into line abreast, and we flew straight at them. It seemed suicidal, as futile as charging one of our frail wooden galleys at the rocks of the cataract. As we came together, our archers fired head-on into the Hyksos, aiming for the horses. Gaps opened in their line as the animals were brought down by our arrows. Then, at the last possible moment, our own line dissolved like wind-driven smoke. Our drivers used their superior speed and manoeuvrability. Instead of coming into collision with the Hyksos line and being crushed beneath the juggernaut, we swerved into the gaps and raced through them. Not all our chariots escaped, and some were broken and overturned, but Lord Acre led 4 out of every 5 of them through. We emerged at the rear of the Hyksos charge and spun around in a full-locked turn, reforming the line at the gallop and again using our speed to overhaul the Hyksos, coming into them from the rear, firing our arrows into them at shortening range.